continue.
As long as we possibly can.
That's David Graeber speaking on Democracy Now! In 2011, 2 days after the launch of Occupy Wall Street. He died Wednesday at the age of 59 in Venice, Italy. We'll link to the full interview at democracynow.org. David Graeber once wrote, quote, "The ultimate hidden truth of the world is that it's something that we make and could just as easily make differently." And that does it for our show. Remember, on this holiday weekend, stay safe, wear a mask, socially distance, save lives. Happy Labor Day. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is having a program proposal drive. From September 1st through the 14th, we'll be accepting applications for new programs. Submit a one-hour pilot episode along with your application for review and potential airplay. No radio experience is required. Basic audio editing skills preferred. Again, that's KBOO's program proposal drive from September 1st through the 14th. More information can be found online at kboo.fm.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcasts, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the suspect in the shooting of Patriot Prayer member Aaron J. Danielson was shot and killed by police last night. Governor Brown calls for peace in Portland and proposes a community forum as the Proud Boys plan their return. And Mayor Wheeler has joined three other big city mayors to respond to Trump's threats. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 4th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon. The Portland man suspected of fatally shooting a far-right demonstrator was killed last night by police near Olympia, Washington. 48-year-old Michael Forrest Rinell was a suspect in the shooting death of Aaron J. Danielson, who was killed during last weekend's pro-Trump rally in Portland. Acting on a Portland arrest warrant, a federally led fugitive task force attempted to arrest Rinell as he left an apartment complex in Lacey, Washington, at about 7:30 p.m. last night. According to the Thurston County Sheriff's Office, Rinell got into a vehicle and, quote, "as they attempted to apprehend him, there was gunfire. He then attempted to flee on foot. Additional shots were fired and Rinell was killed. Authorities say that he pulled a handgun during the arrest attempt. Witnesses to Thursday night's shooting say they heard police fire off 40 to 50 rounds, but could not confirm whether Rinell had fired at the police himself. Portland police had issued a warrant for Rinell's arrest earlier on Thursday, saying there was probable cause to arrest him for second-degree murder and unlawful use of a firearm. He was the prime suspect in the killing of 39-year-old Danielson, who was shot in the chest in a clash between protesters and a caravan of Trump supporters in downtown Portland last Saturday evening. Danielson had affiliations with various far-right groups, including Portland-based Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys, both of whom share a history of violence. During an interview which aired on Vice News hours before he was shot by police, Rinell admitted to shooting Danielson, but said it was in self-defense and that he and a friend were about to be stabbed. Rinell said he had been a regular presence at anti-racism demonstrations in Portland. He also expressed concern that the struggle was becoming a war and that there would be casualties. A report in today's New York Times stated that Rinell was part of the protesters' security team during the demonstrations. Fellow protesters say his role included intercepting potential agitators and helping calm conflicts. The report went on to say that an hour before his death, he was in contact with a friend discussing what to do about his 17-year-old son and 11-year-old daughter if something happened to him. Governor Brown started out her coronavirus press conference this morning with a plea for peace in Portland and a plan. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Ray Bodwell.
In a Salem press conference this morning, Oregon Governor Kate Brown stressed that the violence in Portland must stop. She started out by recapping the legislative and policy changes that have been implemented at the state level as a result of statewide protests for racial justice and police reform over the last 3 months, and announced a community forum to continue with those efforts.
The protests in support of racial equity and police accountability started many weeks ago. During this period, state elected leaders, working with community leaders from around the state, have attempted to rise to that call. Here's what we've done so far. We passed 6 bills improving police accountability, limiting police use of chokeholds, limiting the use of tear gas by law enforcement for crowd control, and limiting the ability of an arbitrator to overturn police discipline. We passed the historic Oregon Cares Fund for Black Relief and Resiliency, dedicating $62 million to support Black individuals, nonprofits, and businesses who've been hit extremely hard during the pandemic. We established dedicated funding at the Oregon Health Authority for community-based organizations to further support our communities of color, tribal communities, and vulnerable populations across the state during the pandemic. I established the Public Safety and Training Standards Task Force. They are working to develop recommendations to re-envision law enforcement training and create new standards to hold law enforcement accountable. Finally, I launched a statewide Racial Justice Council to center racial equity in future budget and policy decisions. For those who have experienced racism and discrimination firsthand, I know that slow and steady progress toward justice doesn't feel fast enough. It isn't. We have to create the space for healing and conversation so we can achieve racial justice. That's why, included in my plan to bring peace to Portland, is a community forum where I'm inviting protest organizers and community leaders to a forum where we'll work toward racial justice and police reform. The forum will start meeting in the coming days.
She then called for an immediate end to the violence and arson in the city of Portland.
There needs to be a community-wide effort to stop the violence. So we must do both things. We must be tireless in our pursuit of racial justice. We must be tireless in our pursuit of accountability for law enforcement. And we must also work together with responsible law enforcement to end violence and arson in Portland. And this needs to happen immediately.
With Portland's protests having passed the 100-day mark, elected community and business leaders have publicly expressed their frustration with the ongoing disruption. Whether Brown's community forum can help to restore calm remains to be seen. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
The Proud Boys are planning to return to Portland for a rally in Terry Schrunk Plaza later this month. According to group leader Enrique Tario, the group has organized a rally on September 26th as a response to ongoing protests against police violence and racial injustice. They've long targeted Portland as a bastion of progressives and, quote, active leftists, and recently criticized Mayor Ted Wheeler and Governor Kate Brown for not stopping vandalism and police confrontations during demonstrations over the last 100 days. In 2017, they rallied along the Portland waterfront to denounce anti-fascists. This was the same day that Donald Trump promoted a congressional resolution to label left-wing activists as domestic terrorists. A spokesperson for the Portland Police Bureau said that they will prepare for the arrival of the Proud Boys on September 26th, but how they respond is, quote, contingent on who arrives and what they do. Proud Boys are a right-wing neo-Nazi group and are defined as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. The all-male group believes in a white genocide conspiracy theory while promoting and engaging in political violence. The director of the Portland's Independent Police Review said the group is unable to keep up with a rapid rise in complaints. In an interview with KATU yesterday, Director Ross Caldwell confirmed that there are 68 separate investigations linked to the nightly protests, and that the number was expected to rise. He said that was more cases than they'd ever had at one time and was the equivalent of several years' worth of cases. He went on to say that with the staff forced to work from home, it was, quote, less efficient than when we were in the office and you can walk down the hall and talk to five people. Caldwell said that many cases under review are related to use of force. The latest example is that of Tyler Cox, a medic who's been at the protests for the last 100 days. Cox has been charged with assaulting a police officer, but a Monday night video shows him being chased and repeatedly punched in the head by a Portland police officer. Cox believes he was targeted for being a medic. He said that he never fought back and was only trying to protect himself, a claim that the video appears to confirm. In addition to being overwhelmed by the number of investigations, Director Caldwell expressed his concerns with the limitations of the Independent Police Review and the lack of transparency. He said that investigation results are shared with the mayor and police chief, but that state law and the police union contract prevent the public from seeing most of the results. He's pushing for a change in the law and said, quote, I would love nothing more than to be able to release every single investigation we do to everybody in Portland to read and see what they're getting for their tax dollars. The Oregon Food Bank is supporting a measure that would decriminalize drugs and increase funding for addiction recovery services. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
September is Hunger Action Month, and in Oregon, anti-hunger advocates are volunteering, donating, and pledging to vote out hunger. Susanna Morgan, who heads Oregon Food Bank, says hunger is at its highest level in a century because of the economic fallout from COVID-19. And with the election coming up, she says people have a chance to vote on public policy changes that will help in the fight against food insecurity.
We have a number of ballot initiatives that are happening statewide and in the Portland metro area that will help us build communities and create the kind of infrastructures where it will be harder to have hunger happen.
Morgan says Oregon Food Bank is supporting the statewide Measure 110, which would decriminalize drug possession and divert marijuana tax revenue to fund addiction services. Oregon ranks next to last in the nation for access to mental health and substance use services, according to Mental Health America. Haven Wheelock is a chief petitioner for Measure 110 and works with the group Outside In and its Drug Users Health Services Program in Portland. She's seen people prioritize their addiction over getting a meal, and also the stigma that comes with substance use disorders. Wheelock believes Measure 110 is about human rights.
Anything we can do to help lift people out of poverty is going to improve the fact that people are going hungry in our community. And by supporting families and people who have substance use disorders, we will improve access to food and food security for folks.
Wheelock is convinced the ballot measure also would mean fewer Oregonians in jails and prisons, noting that people with criminal records have less economic stability and less access to social services. Opponents of Measure 110 believe it will lead to increased drug use. Oregon Food Bank also supports a Multnomah County measure to provide universal preschool. Morgan says it would level the playing field for people of all racial and economic backgrounds, and that education is a key anti-hunger building block. She sees racial justice work as anti-hunger work.
We would urge people as part of voting out hunger to also support continued work towards racial justice, such as police accountability measures.
September 10th is Hunger Action Day. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler has joined the mayors of Seattle, New York, and Washington, D.C. in a statement condemning President Trump's threat to defund, quote, lawless cities. The mayors accuse the president of using millions of Americans as political pawns while they fight locally against the pandemic and economic disaster without another stimulus. The statement went on to say, quote, now, instead of leadership from the White House, we are faced with new attacks that are unlawful, unconstitutional, and will be undoubtedly defeated in court. The mayors were responding to a White House memo from Wednesday in which the president threatened to cut federal funding to cities if they continue to allow anarchist behavior. In the memo, Trump said, quote, my administration will not allow federal tax dollars to fund cities that allow themselves to deteriorate into lawless zones. Wheeler initially responded to the president's threat with a tweet stating, quote, this is a new low, even for this president. He went on to accuse the president of embracing a political strategy of a disenfranchising people based on political grudges. In a Twitter response to the president's memo, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin said, quote, American cities will not be distracted by Trump's actions. We will continue to make our cities more just and equitable. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Tonight, we can expect clear skies with an overnight low in the high 50s. Tomorrow, we'll see a partly cloudy morning that will give way to a sunny afternoon with a high of about 80. On this day in 1957, Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus called out the National Guard to bar African-American students from entering Little Rock High School. The order was given despite the unanimous 1954 Supreme Court ruling outlawing segregation in public schools. President Eisenhower subsequently sent the 101st Airborne to ensure that the ruling would be defended and the students allowed to enter. Today's quote is from Melba Patillo, one of the 9 African-American students who were trying to start school that day. She said, quote, the humiliating expectations and traditions of segregation creep over you, slowly stealing a teaspoonful of your self-esteem every day. To have a chance of winning in November, the Republican Party has realized it must distract Americans from the president's dreadful response to the coronavirus. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts.
With 2 months to go and trailing badly in the polls, Donald Trump and his Republican allies have begun a two-step effort to rewrite the electoral narrative, and indeed to rewrite history. It began last week at the Republican National Convention. Despite the fact that the U.S. has lost and continues to lose more people to COVID-19 than any other country on Earth, convention speakers repeatedly referred to the coronavirus in the past tense while trying to paint that as a result of Trump's rapid response at the beginning. Here's son Don Jr. describing his dad's heroic action.
The virus struck. The president quickly took action and shut down travel from China.
Unfortunately, that was the only thing his dad did, and it was weeks after other countries had taken similar actions. Clearly, Republicans knew that pointing to the president's response to the coronavirus wouldn't stand up to any scrutiny, so the next step was to make law and order the central plank, and in fact, the only plank in the Republican Party's platform.
President Trump and I know that the men and women that put on the uniform of law enforcement are the best of us. Every day, when they walk out that door, they consider our lives more important than their own. We've seen violence and chaos in the streets of our major cities. So let me be clear. The violence must stop, whether in Minneapolis, Portland, or Kenosha. We will have law and order on the streets of this country.
This is not really new territory for the president. Here's an excerpt from his acceptance speech at the 2016 Republican National Convention.
On January 20th of 2017, the day I take the oath of office, Americans will finally wake up in a country where the laws of the United States are enforced.
The White House has repeatedly endorsed the position that blue lives matter, and 2 weeks ago, Trump accepted the endorsement of the City of New York Police Benevolent Association and its 24,000 members. And in his speech to the NYPD, he lamented that protesters had clashed violently with the police who had not been allowed to fight back. He promised that he would be, quote, pro-cop all the way. But if you view that statement in the context of our pandemic-stricken country, it seems a bold statement. Citing two nonprofits that have tracked law enforcement fatalities for years, the Washington Post reported yesterday that more cops have died from COVID-19 than while on patrol doing their jobs. Year-to-date, at least 100 have died from the virus, while 81 have died in the line of duty, including 35 by gunfire and nearly the same number in auto accidents. The number one responsibility of the president, who is also the commander-in-chief, is to protect the citizens of our country. And with over 6 million infected and more than 185,000 dead from a pandemic that Trump has made no effort to fight, all of us, including the cops, should question whether any of our lives matter to him. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
North Carolina will begin sending out its general election ballots today, and Facebook announces new policies to combat election misinformation, but critics and advocates say that the social media giant must do more. With more on these stories and others, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Trump knows a swing state when he sees one, and so he knows that North Carolina is a state that he needs to win the election.
That's Western Carolina University Professor Chris Cooper. A new North Carolina poll shows Donald Trump and Joe Biden neck and neck in the swing state Trump won by a slim margin. It's the first state to begin voting. Ballots are being sent out today. 2 months from the election, 20 times more ballots than in 2016 have already been requested.
The increase is apparent across all types of voters, but the increase is much greater amongst Democratic voters than Republican voters.
North Carolina's State Board of Elections warned yesterday not to follow President Trump's suggestion that supporters mail their ballots and vote in person to, quote, make sure it counted, unquote. It's a felony to knowingly vote twice. Sylvia Albert with Common Cause's Voting Rights Program believes Trump has something else in mind.
It's clear to me that his goal is to undermine the integrity of the election. But thankfully, we have systems in place that bar that from being able to happen. North Carolina, like every state, has laws in place to ensure that eligible voters can only vote one ballot that counts.
Instead of illegally voting twice, voters can track their ballots on the election board's website. Both Facebook and Twitter flagged Trump's posts promoting double voting. Facebook added new measures to remove or tag posts with fraudulent election information and block new political ads the week before November 3rd. Jessica Gonzalez with Free Press thinks Facebook is missing an opportunity.
It's a blanket ban on political, so like they're not going to invest the time that it does take and the money it takes to actually just root out hate and disinformation, which would be the better tactic.
Yesterday, Homeland Security warned that Russian operatives are amplifying false information about mail-in ballots. Gonzalez wants Facebook to do more.
They also need to just flat out ban the use of their event pages for calls to arms, with a particular focus on white supremacists and militia groups. We're just seeing this phenomenon happen again and again.
Rashad Robinson from Color of Change says already marginalized communities are targeted more often.
What we all need to be looking out for is the misinformation and the disinformation that show up on the platforms, all focused on ensuring that the Black vote, the Black voice, and Black energy and power and culture is suppressed.
In sharp contrast to Trump's visit to Kenosha, Wisconsin, Biden spoke on the phone with Jacob Blake, now paralyzed from a police officer's 7 shots. Later at a community gathering, Biden listened to residents talking about issues they're facing, including racism in the legal system and problems for business owners amidst the social and economic unrest.
Win or lose, I'm going to go down fighting. I'm going to go down fighting for racial equality, equity across the board.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A village in southeast Alaska has been given permission to hunt out of season during the pandemic, but the state is trying to block it. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Native rights group is backing the Federal Subsistence Board's decision to allow a village in southeast Alaska to hunt out of season during the pandemic. The state has challenged the move. The issue is now headed to court, as Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports.
The Native American Rights Fund is asking the court to intervene on behalf of the organized village of Cake, which took advantage of the emergency hunt to take 2 moose and 5 deer. The meat was distributed to the community during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. NARF attorney Eric Doherty Lynch in Anchorage says the state's legal challenge to special subsistence hunts like Cakes is part of a larger tug-of-war between the state and federal managers.
Really, the state is seeking to disrupt the federal regulatory scheme that has governed subsistence hunting for decades. And, in general, I would say that the state's actions are extremely disappointing and part of a long pattern of fighting Alaska Native subsistence rights in the courts and the press.
The Federal Subsistence Board also cited public safety concerns to restrict an area north of the Glen Highway to local subsistence hunters. The State Department of Fish and Game filed a lawsuit against the feds last month, alleging both actions violated federal law. It's asking a federal judge for an injunction that would immediately reopen caribou and moose hunting to non-subsistence hunters. Assistant Attorney General Cheryl Brooking says the state isn't going after tribal sovereignty, but sees discrimination against non-natives.
So we've got a situation where they've shown that they're going to disregard their own guidelines, but they don't have to have any facts that indicate that there's actually a food security issue and that they're going to discriminate between whether you're native or non-native.
Tribe members have testified that it wasn't just about scarcity. Elders needed access to traditional foods, including wild game, not just store-bought meat, which wasn't fresh and was relatively expensive. Brooking says the state doesn't see that as reason enough to allow hunting out of season. A federal judge will hear oral arguments from both sides on September 8th, whether to grant a preliminary injunction. Attorneys for Sea Alaska, the region's Native corporation, have also joined the case in support of the federal government and tribes. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Some tribes are starting to modify their COVID-19 measures. The Pueblo of Zuni in New Mexico is lifting its 57-hour weekend curfew after COVID-19 cases stabilized. Zuni Incident Commander Aldred Chiama addressed the community Thursday in a video message with tribal officials.
We had just got through with the phase 4 where it was known as 57-hour curfew, extended curfew, that we just got through. And the main purpose of that was to see if we could stabilize our positive numbers, which indeed it did. We have been going almost like a full month without having to have a positive case in our numbers.
A daily curfew will remain in place and will be extended by an hour. The Pueblo is still closed to non-residents. Zuni Pueblo reported 489 COVID-19 cases. Numbers have not changed in 4 weeks, according to officials. Residents were advised if numbers start to increase, safety measures will likely be reinstated. In Arizona, the White Mountain Apache tribe is now allowing non-residents to engage in some recreational outdoor activities, including camping and fishing. The reservation-wide COVID-19 curfew is now at 10 p.m. The tribal council also approved allowing church services and traditional ceremonies to begin, which went into effect this week. According to the White Mountain Apache tribe, there have been 2,404 positive COVID-19 cases since April 1st. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 4th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade, Ray Bodwell, and Althea Billings. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, we're going to hear three archived but relevant conversations. In June of 2017, we